And we're in the process of going through what some people call the sundry laws or miscellaneous laws in Deuteronomy. Okay, so yesterday we did make a start into chapter 23 of Deuteronomy. So we're in Deuteronomy chapter 23. I've got a note that we're picking up in verse 7. Although I should note, verse 7 is continuing a thought that was there earlier, and it's talking about people of other nations coming into what it says, the assembly of the Lord. And we talked about the question of what is that? You know, and there have been various ideas about what it is because the Bible itself doesn't provide a definition. Some have taken it to mean coming into the nation of Israel at all. I think that's stretching it, you know, even living there. Some have said it refers to any type of office or position. Some thought, which I lean towards, that it might be some type of representative assembly, like the leaders, the elders from around the area. One thing I haven't mentioned but was worth it, Kayla had the question yesterday, could it be referring to assembling for worship? And while I don't tend to, I'm not sure that it is, but there's nothing to prove that it's not. But one of the reasons I tend to not lean that way is because God traditionally hasn't pushed people away from joining worship, but we do know in the ritual system, if someone had any type of ritual uncleanness, like they touched a dead body, or they had some kind of fluid coming out of them somewhere that it wasn't normal, you know, like an open sore or something, they weren't allowed to come into the temple then. We've made the distinction that now that we're a spiritual temple, the Spirit of God is always in us, we don't exclude ourselves from joining the rest of the congregation. At least not for ritual reasons. If you have the flu, please don't join the rest of the congregation. That's an ongoing thing. So anyways, the Moabites and Ammonites, it said they were excluded up to the 10th generation. Okay, which might be an idiom for just never. But God makes a difference for the Edomites and the Egyptians. That's where we pick up in verse 7. Don't abhor the Edomite, he's your brother. The Edomites were closer relatives than the Moabites and Ammonites. If you go up the family tree, remember, Esau was Jacob's twin brother, whereas the Moabites and Ammonites were Lot's children. They were the cousins. Not to say there's a huge difference, but God makes a distinction there. So his children, well, the Edomite also, he mentions the Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. Okay, it's easy to say, wait a minute, the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites. And yes, they did, but before they enslaved them, they brought them all in and took care of them during the famine, largely because of Joseph being inspired by God to prepare for that famine. But the Egyptians, you know, the Israelites were in their land, they survived and were fed, so God is reminding them that they didn't just enslave you, they also did take you in and took care of you. So in verse 8, the children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. I don't have a lot more to say, but again, this is something that seemed to pertain to the physical nation of Israel, not something we have to find a way to apply to our church. Other than we can say that, you know, we've seen in other places, the sins of the fathers can affect the children. Although we've also seen God doesn't hold them directly responsible, but he'll let effects linger, and we have to take conscious action to overcome those. Let's shift gears then. As we go into verse 10, we'll actually start at verse 9. When the army goes out against your enemies, keep yourself from every wicked thing, okay? When the army goes out, that means a lot of young men away from their families, and guess what? Men are slobs. Men are pigs to some degree. We've been called that. You know, young men away from the influence of their parents and the civilizing effect of women, they can fall into, you know, into wickedness, as it says here. And so there's some rules for the camp aside from just stay out of trouble. Actually, I had a note here. If you study, you know, I've studied military history a lot. Modern biography show that even some foremost of our soldiers, at times when they're away from their families, had trouble. U.S. Grant is one that's a good example. Was one of our greatest generals, you know, fighting in the Civil War, considered to be a mediocre president. But, you know, his time as a lower-level officer, he was known for getting involved, basically drinking too much. And if you study his life, you would find that when he was away from his family and bored and depressed, that's when it would tend to happen. And I just cite that as an example. You're away from your family, there's plenty opportunity for trouble, it can come up. And God says, don't, you know, keep away from every wickedness. We think the next couple verses are still in that setting of when, you know, the army goes out, such as in verse 10. If there's any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, he'll go out of the camp. Don't come inside. So something causes ceremonial uncleanness. You know, bathing is required, the ritual water. So that applies when they're traveling in the camp. Have a place for them to go. Verse 12, also you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment. This is a better translation. The old King James says, put a paddle on your sword, that when you sit down outside, you shall dig and turn it and cover your refuse. Basically, it's saying if you have to go potty, bury it. This is what, in modern terms, we'd say when the army goes out, have a latrine. Dig, you know, the latrine, make sure that refuse is taken care of, not just people going out and going wherever they want. And believe me, young men will do that. I learned that at summer camp, especially at Camp Heritage, where we were in these two-man tents. We counselors were always telling the boys, go to the latrine. Don't stand inside your tent and pee out the opening, because boys would do that. And it's on the ground. It's disgusting. And God makes that point. You know, cover your refuge. Verse 14, he says, why? For, or because the Lord God walks in the midst of your camp. He says, I'm not going to explain to you about germs, microbes, bacteria. I'm just telling you, I'm walking around out here, so cover your stuff. It's good common sense, but sometimes an authority figure has to tell people good common. Oh, that just reminded me of another camp story. This one, well, it's kind of amusing. It goes to show, you know, my good friend Ryan McNeely, Mr. McNeely's son, he was a really good counselor, and he liked to work with the youngest dorm. And actually, I developed a practice for a few years when I got too old to be a counselor, but I still liked being around the dorm. I would just, instead of living in the staff house, I would live with their dorm. They'd give me a tent, and, you know, at the beginning of camp, I remember he as a counselor, he'd say, I'm your daddy while we're here. The assistant counselor, he's like your mother, and, well, that's your weird uncle dunkle. which some kids would call me that over the years. But I remember at Camp Heritage, they had this ship. Any of you guys remember that? Okay, they had that, and they had bunks inside. It was set up, you know, it was made to look kind of like a ship, but it had bunks, and you could go. And Ryan was the first counselor to ask his dad, hey, can we go spend the night there? So, which they did, you know. And I remember one evening, you know, me and the two counselors were up on the deck just chatting, looking at the stars, and we see some of the fellas do need to go out and relieve themselves. And then we see one of them chasing the others around. Yeah, so we had a new rule in camp, and Ryan was not one to have a lot of rules. I'm trying to think, one of his rules was, okay, when the counselors are talking, you listen. Pay attention to what we do. His second rule was, this is for 13, 12-year-old boys, you have to get with the ladies. Meaning, you're past the point where you say they have cooties, go talk to the girls, spend time. After that night, he instituted a third rule, no peeing on each other. And you think, would you ever think we'd need to make that rule? But would you think God would have to tell the camp of Israel, take a paddle or take a shovel and cover what comes out of you? Because I'm walking around here. So sometimes you do have to state the obvious. And it gives you a chance to tell funny stories. I've never had that come up at Camp Ketubic, thankfully. I'm hoping it didn't happen without me knowing about it. So anyways, he would say, he doesn't want to see any unclean thing among you. So good hygiene, waste disposal. As I said, God knew all about bacteria. They didn't, and he didn't bother to explain it to them. He gave them a common sense reason. Okay, let's move on in verse 15. This is in a society where slavery, remember, was common in all nations. He said, you shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. He may dwell with you in your midst in the place which he chooses within your gate. So a runaway slave, don't send him back. Most scholars studying the time period and the Hebrew believe this is referring to slaves escaped from neighboring nations not necessarily to those within the nation of Israel. They already had a system like after 6 years, you'll be freed and you got to set them up. So they don't think this is referring to that necessarily. Or even some will say maybe we're still talking about when the camp goes out to war. The previous two restrictions were about when your young men go out to war. This might be saying if slaves escape from the enemy side, come across the line and defect to you, just set them free. Don't send them back. And actually, I think that's a fairly likely explanation. It's worth putting this in the context of American history. Before the United States Civil War, Northern abolitionists cited this scripture here in Deuteronomy 23, 15, and 16 to refuse to obey the Fugitive Slave Act that was passed in 1850. And if John Brown, if he were to come back and visit again, would cite this scripture fairly often, along with remember if your enemy's in chains, you know, remember what it's like to be in chains with him. That's a bad paraphrase, but I didn't remember the exact scripture. Okay, moving on. Verse 17, there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel. Okay, you know, that temple prostitutes, we don't do that. That's not how you worship me. Or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. That seems to be referring to homosexuals doing the same thing. And furthermore, based on that, don't bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog to the house of the Lord, your God. So the proceeds from such practices, you know, they call prostitution the world's oldest profession, which I hope it's not really, but God doesn't want money from that. Now, the price of the dog is something that's caused confusion. Does that mean if you're a dog breeder, you don't tithe on the increase of selling your puppies? That's not what it's about. By the way, my brother-in-law, they raise, what is it, they breed some type of cat, some dog called a Cavalier with Bichon Frises to get some kind of mix, and they sell them for like $2,000 or $3,000 a piece, the puppies. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And this isn't about that. The price of a dog is referring, that's an idiom for male prostitutes. So we don't want the proceeds from female prostitutes or from male prostitutes. So it's a figure of speech in the Hebrew that they translated literally into English, but it's not talking about selling canines. It's talking about something much more evil. And as I said, God doesn't want the proceeds from that coming into his treasury. Okay, we're continuing on. In verse 19, don't charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that's lent out at interest. To a foreigner you may charge interest, but not your brother, that the Lord your God may bless you in all you set your hand to. This is referring back to a law previously given. We see it in Exodus 22, verse 25. So Exodus 22, 25, and again in Leviticus 25, verse 36. And I made the point then that most people understand this is not forbidding banks doing their job and lending money for like commercial investment or anything like that and charging interest. It's about charging interest when you're helping the needy and the poor. And I think it was it just yesterday I talked about, you know, when you understand the year of release coming up and says, don't let your heart be evil and say, hey, he might not repay me, so I'm not going to give him the loan. You know, rather, you should consider, should I just give it to him then? And I said, deciding whether to help someone who's poor, base it on their need and on your ability, not necessarily on whether you can make money off of it. And that fits with what God's saying here. But the idea of making interest off of an investment, remember Jesus Christ used the parable of the pounds and the parable of the talents that does support that that's okay. Got to move my post-it note. Verse 21, we got several verses here. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, don't delay to pay it. The Lord your God will require it of you. But if you abstain from vowing, it won't be a sin. So you don't have to make any vows. But if you do, carry them out. Verse 23 says, what has come out of your lips, you shall keep and perform. Is you voluntarily vowed. So nobody made you do it. Okay, this repeats what we read back in Numbers 30 and verse 2. As I said, a lot of this is repetition of what came earlier. Of course, this is a younger generation that might not be keeping up. Connect with that Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 5. Solomon was very aware of this. Solomon said, it's better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And you could say God is saying that exactly here. That was Ecclesiastes 5:5. But Jesus Christ, you could say, took it a step further. What did he teach? I'm sure you all know. You might not know chapter and verse, but what did Christ tell us about vows?
Don't do it.
As simple as that. This head shake. No, just don't vow. Matthew 5, verse 34 is where you can find that. Swear not is what he said. Don't swear a vow. And he made the point because you don't have the power to control things. You can't make your hair white or black. As I said, I've tried. It doesn't work. You can't control how tall you're going to be. You know, there's circumstances beyond your control that you don't know about, so it's better to let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't make vows. But if you do make a vow, God's going to hold you responsible. Okay, we move beyond that, and we get some another more common sense stuff in verse 24. When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat grapes. It says you can eat your fill of grapes, but do not put a single one in a container. So if you're wandering on land that's not yours and there's some kind of fruit growing, it's okay to pick and eat, you know, even quite a bit, but you can't put a single one in a container. You can't go in and harvest his crop. That is stealing. The same goes for standing grain in verse 25. You come into the grain, you can pluck the heads with your hand. Don't use a sickle, though. So God is building in a certain amount of required hospitality. People are traveling, they're hungry, there's food. It's okay. But they can't stock up, you know. And you could apply this maybe in a lot of different ways. You know, how many, this might apply to your parents more than you, and it probably does for me too. If people show up, oh, are you hungry? I got to feed you. My mother-in-law is like that. You go to, even today, Sue and I show up in her house, she's trying to feed us as soon as we walk in the door. You know, and she goes further, she won't let us leave without taking food home with us. But here he's saying there's something required. If people show up, they can eat, you know, and even in absence. There's a case of the disciples with Jesus Christ doing that. When the Pharisees accused them of breaking the Sabbath, you see it in Matthew 12, verses 1 through 8. And it's repeated in Mark 2, verses 23 to 28. When it's on the Sabbath day, it says they're walking through the fields and they plucked grain. And basically, it's ripe enough, they would do this to get the husks, blow the husks off, and you've got little kernels of grain, pop it in your mouth and chew it up, you know, and I've heard that's the original fast food. You know, you get it, you do that, and you can eat it. And the Pharisees say, you're harvesting on the Sabbath. Jesus, we're not harvesting, we're just getting a bite to eat. And this fits with what the law says we're allowed to do. Christ made the point that even on the Sabbath, it's okay to do this. Now, yes, Julie?
What were those verses?
First one, Matthew 12, 1 through 8, and it's paralleled in Mark 2, 23 to 28. And in your harmony of the Gospels, though, does it be put together side by side on the page. Now, some people, you know, there's discussion and disagreement within the church of whether it's okay to eat at a restaurant or not on the Sabbath. And I don't want to get into that disagreement, but some people will cite what this says along with Christ and his disciples to say, well, if you're traveling on the Sabbath and you get hungry, it's okay to get something to eat. You know, now, Christ and his disciples didn't walk up to a counter and hand over money and have someone hand them a burger. They walked through the fields and plucked grain and processed it. You could argue how much is it work and how much is it not work. And I'm not going to say there's a definitive answer. I'm just making the point that some people put these together to help answer the question. So I'll leave it at that because the church has said, okay, it's a conscious matter. You know, as far as whether or not you would choose to spend money on the Sabbath to eat, not in your home. And whatever your conscience leads you to do, be fine with that, but don't judge other people's conscience. That's been our official teaching on that matter. Okay, so let's move on to chapter 24. When a man takes a wife and marries her, okay, that's what men and women do when they get married, and it happens she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some uncleanness in her. Okay, there's no definition of what the uncleanness is. It's not defined. In ancient Israel, men would go on to take this to mean anything they found objectionable. So we found later on, studies, you know, history shows that men were very liberal. It's like, I don't like the way you cooked my dinner. That's uncleanness. You're out of here, lady. I don't think that's what God ever intended. So let's be clear that what the Israelites did with this might have been not what God had in mind. But he puts in her hand a certificate of divorce and sends her out of his house. Interesting, this requires a legal document that, you know, you could question. It doesn't say if he had to go to the elders at the gate of the city to get the certificate, but maybe. So it's a process that doesn't happen. You know, I've heard the jokes that he just has to look and say, I divorce you, and they're divorced. No, this is saying he's got to have a certificate of divorce, even though we don't know exactly what it is. So, and nowadays we have divorce papers people have to sign. It has to go through the court. Matter of fact, I'm looking for, in Mark 10, verses 2 through 12, the Pharisees asked Jesus about divorce, and he made the point, he said, Moses permitted this because of the hardness of your heart. That's Mark 10, verses 2 through 12. It's also in Matthew 19, parallel account. But he says, God didn't intend it that way. Now, let's be clear. Moses didn't do this against God's instruction. So when he says Moses permitted it, it is saying God permitted it. You could say God put up with it, but that's not the way he meant it to be. You know, we understand and we see that from what Christ continued to say when he answered that. From the beginning, God intended marriage to be between one man and one woman for one lifetime, or for the lifetime of those people. That's the intent of marriage. But even Christ admitted it doesn't always work that way. Okay, we don't know what this, you know, uncleanness is, but Jesus gave a valid reason for divorce. He mentioned sexual immorality. Okay, and he didn't define that, and nowadays we've got a committee in the church to try to decide if couples have valid reason for divorce, but sexual immorality, one way is one partner's cheating on the other. You could say that would dissolve the marriage. Okay, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 added another criteria that seems to make divorce okay. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 15, and this is a pretty narrow category. Basically, he's talking about being pleased to dwell with another, and understanding all of what it says there in 1 Corinthians 7 is, if an unconverted mate abandons the marriage, is not pleased to dwell, then the one who's in the church is freed. So, and some I think with Paul's case, it was more often if someone was called into the church and the mate, the husband or the wife, wasn't called or didn't respond to the calling, and they said, I'm not putting up with you doing this crazy Sabbath stuff, I'm out of here. It would say the marriage could be dissolved and the one in the church would be free to remarry. Okay, now, within God's church in modern times, we've added one more criteria, which I don't know, did you guys go over this at all in doctrines or in Epistles of Paul? Does anybody remember what the other criteria is? Kayla seems to.
Something about fraud?
Fraud. Fraud before the marriage, meaning one person presents themselves as something they're not, or they keep something hidden, and our interpretation of this is that the marriage was never valid in the first place because it was founded on a falsehood. So in a sense, it's not really dissolving the marriage. We would look at it and say, God knew all along that there was a fraud, so he didn't bind the marriage. Now, how do we know for sure if that's the case? It's hard to know. You know, we study and get all the information we can and make the best decision. One way or another, we never urge people to end a marriage. You know, that's not something you should take lightly. It seems in ancient Israel, they took it much too lightly and easily. As a church, we say, no, God intended people to be married and stay married for the rest of their lives. Okay, now, what if people get married, maybe they're too young or they didn't know each other that well, but none of those three ground those reasons attach, but they just say, I can't live together with this person. Do they have to stay together in the same house? No, our interpretation, maybe they separate. They're just not allowed to marry someone else. They're legally bound to the other. And you see cases of that happen sometimes. And I don't want to make this all about divorce and remarriage because we cover it in other classes, but since it's coming up here, it's worth us keeping in mind how we fit this into modern times. You know, and God forbid this would ever happen, and I talked to Sue, we were saying, it's like neither one of us ever thought about divorce. You know, we went into it saying, we're stuck forever, and that's okay. But if suddenly we couldn't get along because, you know, she wants to eat her cereal dry and I want milk on mine and we just can't put up with each other, you know, I might move out and go get in an apartment, you know, and we just won't be living together, but that, in God's eyes, we're still married. Neither one of us would be free to marry another person. We didn't have grounds for divorce. We might have grounds for not sticking together. Now, one thing I'll add, and this is a touchy matter, in some cases, even if God considers you married, I could see where there might be a reason to do a legal divorce. Because in modern society, marriage is a sacred union, but it's also a legal contract. You know, I married Sue, she becomes owner of all my stuff. And she can, you know, if I get hit by a truck and I'm unconscious in the hospital, she has legal right to tell him what to do with me. You know, if we're not together anymore because of that whole cereal thing, I might want to eliminate that, even though I'm not free to marry someone else. So do you see what I'm saying? Dissolving the legal contract accomplishes things in the current nation according to these laws, but God would still consider us bound to each other. I hope I'm not confusing the matter. And again, our intention is none of this ever happens. You learn to put up with how your wife eats her cereal. You don't split up because of that or any other reason. Okay, but there's something here. Assuming it does happen, I never finished. Okay, so verse 1, man sees uncleanness, gives her a certificate of divorce. Okay, she's free to marry someone else, and she does. She departs from his house, becomes another man's wife. If the latter husband detests her, oh, I can't stand this woman either. I'm going to divorce her. This is pretty sad. Or maybe it's just she's got to run a bad luck with bad guys. Or the latter husband dies. So maybe he didn't divorce her, but he dies. The former husband who divorced her the first time must not take her back to be his wife after she's been defiled, meaning she's become attached to another man. God says, you can't go back. And he doesn't give really explanation why. He just says it'll be an abomination. Don't bring sin on the land. So he's saying, okay, you're married, that ends, she marries someone else, you can't come back again. And we could have probably spend a long time discussing the whys and wherefores, and I'm not going to because I've spent more time talking about divorce than I ever want to. Okay, let's talk about starting a marriage and it going well instead. Verse 5, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war. We already covered that if he's engaged and he hasn't married her yet, he's excused. But you get married, you're not to go out to war or be charged with any business. He'll be free at home 1 year. It says here, bring happiness to his wife. I prefer the original King James, where he'd be free at home to cheer up his wife. Always like that. It's like, yeah, she needs cheering up after she's stuck being married to me. But it does make sense. A new married couple, don't dump extra stuff on them. Give them time to get used to each other and not have heavy other heavy responsibilities. I don't think this necessarily means you don't have to work for the first year. Okay, you should probably plant your crops or go in and punch the time clock and do your job, but not extra things. And it's a shame, I'd say, in the church, we haven't always fulfilled this. I think we're good about it now, but you hear Mr. Dean talk about back in his days when you'd graduate Ambassador College, the next week get married, and the next week move into a congregation as a ministerial trainee. Maybe it would have been better to give them some time to get used to each other and get their marriage going before they take on that heavy responsibility. But that's, you know, again, trying to put this in modern terms, and it doesn't always quite match up. Okay, verse 6. When a man, no man shall take the lower or upper millstones as a pledge. He takes someone's living for a pledge. This is referring to basically a hand mill in someone's house. It could be operated by one person to grind grain into flour. And it's kind of important to have that. So removing either stone is really impinging on the family's ability to feed themselves. So God's saying, no, you might want collateral for a loan, but not that. So, and that's what it means by a pledge. It's like collateral. Moving on in verse 7, if a man is found kidnapping, any of his brethren mistreats or sells him, the kidnapper shall die. Okay, this is a repeat of Exodus 24, verse 16. Exodus 24, 16, kidnapping and or the slave trade brings the death penalty. And that doesn't take a lot of discussion. I think, yeah, I could see that. Verses 8 and 9, take heed in an outbreak of leprosy, observe and do what the priests, the Levites, commanded you to do. Remember what the Lord did to Miriam. This is referring back to Numbers, I believe, 12, when Aaron and Miriam challenged Moses and God struck Miriam with leprosy. Even she had to go out of the camp for 7 days and go through the ritual cleansing. So this is reminding us of those policies back in Leviticus 13 and 14. Leviticus 13, 14, I describe the priests as operating as public health officers. And here Moses is reminding them, do what I said back there. Follow their authority. Yes, James?
I don't think it's 18,
24. Is it 21, 16? Yes, it is. Okay, typo on my part. Sorry about that. Let me change my notes. I hate it when I do that. Exodus 21, 16. It says, yeah, he who kidnaps a man and sells him, if he's found in hand, will be put to death. Thank you, James, because I don't want to keep passing on inaccuracies. Remember what Mr. Miller said? Be accurate, which means be honest. I wasn't being dishonest, I was just inaccurate. Okay, so follow those public health policies. Moving on, 24, verse 10. When you lend your brother anything, don't go into his house to get his pledge. The pledge, again, is collateral. Say, hey, Nate, can you loan me $20 till next week? He might say, yeah, I'll give you $20 if you give me your coat. You know, so to make sure I get my $20 back. God says, no, don't do that. You know, he needs that. You know, now today I don't need my coat, but by Monday morning I might need it. It says, don't go into his house. Respect his privacy and his human dignity. You can stand outside and he can bring a pledge out. Well, here I got to the house. And verse 13, in any case, return it to him when the sun goes down that he may sleep in his own garment. So there's where the garment or coat comes in. And he'll bless you. This is in a time in a society where clothing was more rare and expensive. People didn't have closets full of clothes that they didn't know what to do with and they had to give away to the Salvation Army. You know, people might be lucky if they had two or three changes of clothes and one jacket. So God is saying, respect that. Don't take that. There's a reference in Amos 2, verse 8. That condemns some in Israel for breaking this. So there's a reference to it hundreds of years later, Amos 2:8. Again, I would say, look, if the people are that poor, just give him the money. You know, I'll give Andrew $20. Andrew, Nate, why do I? I've got your last name set in my head, and that M-A-N difference is getting me messed up. I like to say it's because they look so much alike. Look, they're wearing the same color shirt. I can't tell them apart. Sorry, Kayla.
Just to clarify the distinction, so this is lending to people who are in the church. So back to the interest thing.
Well, there it's in Israel, in the Israel. Nation, yeah.
But if you're like in a business situation with someone, is that different than someone who needs money, like needs
yes,
money for
yes.
being poor?
Yes, yes. If a business situation, say, hey, you know, John Miller came and talked about investing in new equipment. In some cases, it's a big investment. I might have a small business. Well, I'm sure, Tim Cloudis, you've had to borrow money for your business probably. No? Well, never mind. You're not a good example. Say I might be starting up a lawn care business, and I'm going to put Connor to work. Even though he's only 7 years old, he's going to go out and mow grass. I might need money to buy a new Cub Cadet riding mower. I happen to know that Craig has got a stash of money in his bank account. He could give me a couple $1,000 so I can buy this Cub Cadet. Now, I'm not going to expect him to just give it to me, and I'm going to make money. We'll make an arrangement. Okay, if you loan me that couple $1,000, I'll pay you 5% interest, and the loan will be paid back by a certain time. I think that's perfectly acceptable. Now, if I'm down on my luck, and I'm starving, and Connor not only can't mow grass, but he can't eat, I go to Craig and say, can you give me a few bucks to buy some cereal for my kid? He's not going to say, well, are you going to pay me 5% interest, and when's it coming back? See, there's that. I hope that makes the distinction more clear. And see, they take it out of ancient Israel and put it in modern days. It's much more fun. and hopefully understandable. Okay, let's move on to verse 14. Don't oppress your hired servant who's poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or alien. So this doesn't matter if he's Israelite or not. Verse 15, give him his wages each day. Don't let the sun go down on it. Because he's poor, he needs his money. I'm paraphrasing. Now, is this a command that if you're an employer, you have to have a daily payday? No. Basically, that's what they did for day laborers back then. As in Jesus Christ doing the parable of the vineyard. We went out where there are people who you could hire for a day and say, hey, go work in the vineyard, I'll pay you what's right. And at the end of the day, they paid them. We could take this to mean, though, you pay when payday comes. If I'm an employer and I pay on a weekly basis, pay them when payday comes. If it's biweekly, once a month, make sure you pay when you said you would pay, because they're counting on that. Don't say, well, I know payday's Friday, but I'm not going to have the money till next Tuesday, and that's just tough luck for you. You know, that's not the way God wants us to do things. Okay, verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. A person will be put to death for his own sin. Individual responsibility. It'd be good to reference this to Ezekiel chapter 18, which I've said many times, that's the chapter that expounds on this further, but this one verse makes it pretty clearly. Yeah, Ezekiel 18, and yeah, 18, what is it, Ezekiel 18:4, the soul that sins shall die? Or is it 18:5? That's bad, that's a grandma scripture. I should have that very clear in my head. I was explaining to the Lexington congregation about grandma scriptures when I was down there for Unleavened Bread. So if they ask you about it, you got to back me up and say he really does say that in class. Okay, next several verses. Don't pervert justice, do the stranger or the father, or take a widow's pledge. Remember, you were a slave in Egypt and God redeemed you. That's why I command you this thing. When you reap your harvest, if you forget a sheaf in the field, don't go back and get it. It's for the stranger and fatherless. When you beat your olive trees, don't go over the boughs again. And by beat the trees, that's some... Nowadays, they'll have mechanical shakers. They spread a cloth under an olive tree, and it shakes the tree, and the ripe ones fall off. Back then, I think they actually would take a big stick and bang, 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 and the stuff falls off. Well, some of them aren't ripe enough to fall off, and he's saying, don't go back. Why not? Let the poor people go get it. Let Ruth, gathering food for her and her mother-in-law, Naomi, go and do some gleaning and get some food. Ruth is the example that we know the story of. So the same thing in verse 21, for grapes in your vineyard. In verse 22, remember you are a slave in the land. This is, assuming I don't have typos here, this is a repeat of what we saw going back to the judgments. Exodus 22, verses 21 to 23, is where the idea of don't glean, don't. It also says don't harvest the corners of your fields. So that was Exodus 22, 21 to 23. Comes up in Leviticus 19, verse 9, and Leviticus 23, 22. So again, the way I see it is gleaning was for the able-bodied poor. Hey, you can get some support, but you need to be able to go, willing to go work. But there was also the third tithe system for some people who couldn't go work. Say I'm 98 years old and I'm destitute, but I can't go out and glean in the fields. You know, third tithe should be taking care of that. And okay, so chapter 25. If a dispute between men and men, they come to the court, the judges may judge them. Okay, so there's a criminal justice system and the judges will make a decision. Verse 2, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, they'll make him lie down and be beaten, according to his guilt, with a certain number of blows. So the judges can determine. Now notice, we're talking about corporal punishment. In Israel's system, we don't see incarceration as a punishment. The closest thing to it is if you have to stay in the city of refuge till the death of the high priest. But there's limits to corporal punishment. Verse 3, 40 blows you might give and no more, lest you beat him with many blows and your brother be humiliated, dehumanized, you could say. So a Jewish culture developed into putting the limit at 39. And the main reason for that is, what if we lose count? What if I'm giving 40, but I skipped a beat and I gave him 41? I'm violating God's law. I don't want to do that. So the Sanhedrin would say 39, just in case you miscounted. And I think it's good to have this limit. Other cultures over the years did not. And I think notably in studying military history, the British Navy was notorious. You know, they would grab guys out of bars when they were too drunk to know that they joined the Navy and they wake up on a ship. Stuff like that. And if you violated an order of the captain on the ship, you could be flogged. And there are cases of sometimes them assigning 400 lashes. And they'd lash them until they passed out, and then they'd put them in the brig until they got healthy and lash them some more until they got to the number. God's way says, no, you don't do that. 40 blows is enough. You know, and hopefully you'll learn the lesson from that. And notice it has to be done in the presence of the judge. Because it's easy for me to say, okay, haul James out and give him 1,000 knocks on the head. But it's different for me to stand there and watch, because after 5 or 6, I might say, oh, that's enough. Man, cut it out. You're killing the guy. So if the judge is there present, he's going to be more human about it. Sorry, James, not wanting to hit you on the head. But okay, so, you know, God has these things in mind. Verse 4 is a very familiar scripture because we see it in the New Testament. You shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out grain I started going to the next verse. This refers to oxen on a threshing floor. I think I mentioned this in the book of Ruth. You'd put the grain on a flat surface and the oxen would just walk around on it, and that'd bunch it up, and the thicker, more dense grain would fall out. And a lot of times they'd have a pitchfork and they'd do this and toss it up in the air, and the dried husks and the stems would blow away in the wind. So that was how they separated the kernel, the wheat from the chaff. Is the chaff is the husks and the stems. But having that heavy weight, you know, sometimes they'd use a roller, but having the ox walk around on it does the job. And he's saying, while they're walking around there with all that food, let them eat some of it. Let them participate. They're doing all the work to get the grain. Let them eat a little bit of it, which is nice. It's humane to your animals. The Apostle Paul says, yeah, there's more to that, right? What did Paul interpret that to mean? Maybe I should have started there. You know, remember Paul said, does God care for oxen? And I would say the answer is yes, God does care for oxen, but he also cares for people even more, right? What were you going to say?
He was talking about how as a minister, he was able to benefit from the tithes and offerings that the people gave, that he was allowed to earn from it.
Exactly. You see it in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and there's a several scripture stretch. 1 Corinthians 9 verses 3 through 14. But specifically in verse 14, he says, those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. Just like an ox that's doing all this work to get you some grain should be able to eat some of that grain, a minister who's doing all this work, Paul is saying it's okay that if he lives off of the tithes. Not that he should become wealthy while you guys are starving. That's not at all the intent. But Paul is saying, yeah, does God care for oxen? I would say, yes, he cares for oxen, but he cares even more for people. So, matter of fact, a similar, I would apply this to if I'm running a restaurant. My employees should get to eat either free or at a pretty steep discount. You know, when I worked at Wendy's for 1,000 years, it seemed, you know, I started off with getting a 50% discount. When I became a shift manager, I got at least one free meal per shift. It's like not muzzling the ox when it treads out the grain. What's another example? Some of you guys work retail, right? You get discounts or freebies. Yeah, it's appropriate. It's the same principle comes through. Let's look verses 5 through 10. If brothers dwell together and one dies and he doesn't have a son, the widow of the dead man shall be married not to a stranger, but the husband's brother will go in her and take her as wife. And the firstborn son that she bears will succeed the name of his dead brother. We covered this in the book of Ruth. This is called levirate marriage. And from the Hebrew levir, meaning brother. Okay, so say David and I are brothers. I die before Sue and I have Connor. David's got to marry Sue, and if they have a son, he's named after me. David and I aren't brothers, and I'm not dying. So this is. But the idea is, for one thing, the widow is taken care of. She's not left destitute. First, the brother will take care of her. Then the son will grow up and he'll take care of her in her old age. So it's, you know, meant to do that. Now, there is an out. Verse 7, if the man doesn't want to take his brother's wife, then the brother's wife can go up to the gate to the elder. She goes to the count, you know, the city gate where business is done and say, hey, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name for his brother. He won't perform the duty of a husband's brothers. Elders will call him in. Hey, is this true? You're not willing to marry this woman? Says, yeah, I don't want to take her. You could say, I don't want to take her. Then the brother's wife will come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal and spit in his face and say, so shall it be done to the man who won't build up his brother's house. And his name will be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. Now, in some cases, yes, yeah, spit in my face, call me names, I'm not marrying this woman. Some guys would say that's, you know, they're willing to go through it. Others, you know, it's a public shaming to some degree. Now, remember in the story of Ruth, when the nearer relative whose name we never found out wouldn't marry Ruth or declined the opportunity so Boaz could do it, yeah, he took off his shoe and gave it to Boaz. We didn't have Ruth or Naomi come and spit in his face. And I discussed it, why not? Well, maybe because somebody is there who will build up the house. There's some speculation that maybe it wasn't even related to this. But you know, I think it's largely because there, no shame is needed. There's somebody that wanted to build up the brother's house. Now, we don't do this in the church today. I mentioned if David were my brother and I died, we don't, you know. Some of you guys have brothers, right? Anybody here have a brother who's married? Well, Craig does. Yeah, Kurt dies. Well, they got a daughter, right? No son? Okay, so no son. Craig, got to step in. Okay, we don't teach that. No, you're willing to have your sandal removed, huh? Okay, now why not? Valid question. We've got a minute we can answer. Why don't we do that? It's here in the Bible. You know, remember, in 2 months, you're going to be graduates. People might come up, hey, Nate, you went to Ambassador College. I read this in the Bible. What about that? What did they teach you at Ambassador? Do I have to marry my dead brother's wife or not? Charlie? Yeah, cultural. I agree with that, but there's more to it. What, Julia? Okay, so... law, so does it matter? Oh, okay, so that's one thing. We don't have to take care of the woman. She can own property and inherit herself. Yes, Nate? So we could meet the spirit of this law without it there being a marriage. Yeah, the widow could move in with the brother and he takes care of her. He doesn't have to actually marry her. Now, these are all valid reasons. Also, what was this part of the spiritual law that you have to obey to be a moral person, have a relationship with God, or... could we define it differently? Remember, I've used the term civil law, law for a political unit. That's what this was. This was for the nation of Israel. Are we living in the nation of Israel? No, we're living right now in the United States. We follow its civil laws. So, and that's not to say that, you know, this law was wrong or bad, but there are some laws for governing a political body and taking care of their social institutions. I was making the point, it's not just a social custom that's different, we're in a different legal entity. And within the church also, we've got other laws. For one thing, we've seen in the New Testament, it teaches you shouldn't marry someone who's not in the church. What if your brother's wife isn't in the church, and he's not either? You know, we don't want one law to contradict something else. We also teach that polygamy is wrong. Maybe by the time Kurt dies, Craig's already married. Not allowed to have a second one. So, you know, there's various reasons we could explain to people, yeah, this was for Israel then, and it was part of their nation, but we're not living in the nation of Israel, we're in the church of God. So again, I think the spiritual principle is something we would uphold. Kurt dies, it'd be appropriate for Craig to help take care of the widow. And, of course, her family would also join in. And sorry, I'm picking on you. I just happen to know your brother's married. Okay, so I think we understand that. And we're out of time. I've gone over. So we didn't get through chapter 25. We'll pick it up next week with verse 11. Luckily, these are little you know, bite-sized, you know, law McNuggets that we can go through. I was going to say chicken McNuggets, but so let's go ahead and take a break.